Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Danner, who is a writer, journalist, and professor. Mark Danner was a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and is a regular contributor to The New Yorker Review of Books. He teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, and at Bard College, and his books include Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War, The Secret Way to War, The Downing Street Memo, and The Iraq War's Buried History, and Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. His latest article at The New Yorker Review of Books is Rumsfeld's War and Its Consequences. Now, welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Danner.
Thanks, Ian. It's good to be here.
And Mark, the your article in the New York Review of Books, which is the first of how many are you writing on Rumsfeld, by the way?
Well, the second one just closed, so I believe three will probably do it. I hope.
Well, are you finding it as difficult as Errol Morris did in his new film, which I haven't seen, but I've been reading reviews about it? Apparently, Errol Morris refers to this film of his as a work of hate as opposed to a project of love. You know.
Well, I think this film will inevitably be compared, and I certainly compare it to Errol's film made that appeared just a decade ago called The Fog of War on Robert S. McNamara. Both films, of course, are on defense secretaries. Both are on extraordinarily willful, stubborn, domineering, and extremely intelligent men who were very successful early on in their lives. And then found themselves confounded in both cases by wars that they couldn't win, and wars that they really weren't that thrilled to be fighting for a long time either, by the way. Both wanted to get out very, very quickly. And both now are really, I think, much to their displeasure. McNamara, of course, is gone now, but his displeasure was very clear in The Fog of War. And Rumsfeld is still with us. And both, I think, will be known by their failures in these conflicts in Vietnam and in the Iraq War. To get back to your point about Errol, we can't speak for him, of course, but I have a feeling, or at least a suspicion, that McNamara was a lot easier to interview in many ways than Rumsfeld has been. McNamara was a man who wanted very much to explain himself, who, in a sense, had been seeking redemption ever since he left office, in 67, I believe it was, and he who wanted desperately to explain himself. Rumsfeld is a very different kind of fellow. He seems to be, at least, convinced he is always right. I say seems to be because there is a kind of opaque surface, which I talk about in the New York Review of Books piece, which is rather maddening. You know, you can't get by this surface. And confronted with this, Errol, in a sense, dwells on the surface. So it's rather a different kind of film than The Fog of War. I suspect people will be frustrated that Errol doesn't quite get Rumsfeld. Get, I mean, you know, grab, trap, etc. That Rumsfeld tries and perhaps succeeds in many cases in wriggling out of his grasp. But I think that impression while understandable, is mistaken. I disagree with it. I think Rumsfeld, in many ways, rather traps himself. And I guess one of the points of the New York Review piece that's in the current issue and the one to come is to show the reader and the viewer in what way Rumsfeld has trapped himself.
Well, I recall from the Fog of War, the film that Errol Morris did about McNamara, that McNamara was really quite tortured, and he came up to the cusp of a mea culpa, but never quite delivered. And mm-hmm. Rumsfeld is I think both he and Cheney, and because Showtime did a documentary on Cheney as well, they seem mm-hmm. to be blissfully immune to the reality of what they have wrought. Their smugness reminds me of Somerset Maugham's great line that the great comfort to the mediocre is that they're always at their best.
Oh boy, that is. I didn't know that line, and wish I had. That's a wonderful line. You know, it's an interesting problem in what they really think. I mean, I'll confine what I have to say to Rumsfeld, because that's what the piece is about, and what I've been thinking of, or the person I've been thinking of. It's hard to know whether what you're getting is a reflection of a kind of smug self-satisfaction with what indeed he has done, and a refusal really at all to come to grips with some of the failures, which of course are very striking. The Iraq War is only the most obvious. Or what you have here is the public face of a man who has been a politician, and a quite successful one from a very young age, and is very schooled in how to put to the public a face that is always triumphant, that is always, what's the word, all-knowing?
Confident.
Self-confident, and, you know, a face that is completely without doubt. And I think that is perhaps what we're seeing, this face without doubt. So it's very frustrating.
Well, that's the point that I was making, though, in quoting Somerset Maugham, that you know, if you look at the record of both Cheney and Rumsfeld, not going back to the Ford administration, but since their time in the George W. Bush administration, it has been a spectacular catastrophe. And everything that they thought they were doing, they did the opposite. They thought they were liberating Iraq when, in fact, they handed it over to Iran. They've diminished America's standing in the world. They thought they were standing tall on the world stage. In fact, they've shamed and weakened America. It's just extraordinary how they're not being held to account. And when you this serene confidence that they have is, I think, you know, a part of why they are so mediocre. They don't get it. I mean, and they never will. And that's, of course, I guess, the comfort of being an ideologue.
Well, it's a good question whether there is any introspection, as I said, and whether, you know, if you ever were able to get Rumsfeld or Cheney, for that matter, to sit down and honestly talk to you about what they really thought about the Iraq War. I certainly expect Rumsfeld, in particular, would not cling to the view that everything worked fine and, you know, it was a successful effort. I don't know that he would confess it was a failure on the level that I agree with you it was. I have to believe, I guess I'm saying, is that he is more introspective and thoughtful, certainly, than he comes off in this film. But remember, I think what they would probably say, and certainly to some degree what Rumsfeld does say, and it's something I take up not only in the first part, but even more in the second part of this New York Review essay, is that history, you know, he has a kind of strange, almost mysticism about history. And it's mocked to some degree in the title of Errol's film, The Unknown Known. Some of your listeners will remember in a press conference in which Rumsfeld was asked, you know, where are the weapons of mass destruction? Or do we really know where they are? He launched into this little mini excursus in philosophy, saying, well, you know, they're known unknowns. These are things we don't know, but we know we don't know them. Then there are unknown unknowns, things that we don't know and don't know we don't know. And these are the horrible things that you have to watch out for. And in the film, he applies this characterization, for example, to the attacks on Pearl Harbor in 1941 and the attacks, by implication, the attacks of September 11th. And it's rather fascinating because, in effect, he has, you know, all of this sort of mystical philosophy about history, all these famous Rumsfeld rules and so on. And one of my arguments really is that all of this stuff is deeply political and self-protective. You know, it's a way for him to say, this wasn't my fault. You can't know history for certain. You know, all you can do is try to imagine what might happen, but you can never do this successfully. And if you follow this kind of thinking, you end up with a kind of cosmic get out of jail free card. You know, it's, well, you know, what can we do? Yes, we went into Iraq, but and things went badly, but wars never turn out to be the way you think they will be. You know, this always happens. And he says even more excruciatingly to me, he makes a similar point when it comes to torture and the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques that he approved for Guantanamo, and that then as various commissions testified that investigated these things, migrated, that's their word, migrated to Iraq and were seen in the form of the grotesque Abu Ghraib photographs. You know, he holds that, you know, you can't see around corners. Who could have expected that when I approved these enhanced interrogation techniques that had been legally vetted and judged to be safe and humane and so on, who could have expected that, that you know, what you would end up with is the Abu Ghraib photographs? And I find this absolutely repellent, to tell you the truth. And I go a long way, particularly in the second essay in the New York Review of Books, to prove that indeed this is not the case and that it was foreseeable. And indeed, one of the best moments of the film, Errol Morris's film, The Unknown Known, is when Rumsfeld claims at a certain point, well, you know, it's ridiculous, he says, that anyone could claim that what I approved at Guantanamo could have migrated to Iraq and Abu Ghraib. These things have nothing to do with one another. And as is his custom, he pointed to a specific report that he said proved the opposite. And Errol Morris, to his great credit, and it's in many ways the high point of the film, has the report in his hands, basically. I mean, figuratively speaking, he has the quote. And even as Rumsfeld says this in his defense, Errol actually reads out the quote, which says the precise opposite of what Rumsfeld is claiming it says. And it's a kind of a great moment in the film because he is a man who has very often succeeded by citing things that in fact prove the opposite of what he says at the time. But people very often haven't read the reports. They're not familiar with them. And he's come a long way simply by simple bravado and arrogance and aggressiveness. And Errol, to his, I think, enormous credit, you know, catches him in the act, as it were. One of the most interesting things is Rumsfeld, after he's been caught in this way, simply sits back and says, oh, yes, I guess that's true. He doesn't admit he's been prevaricating. He doesn't. It's really a remarkable moment. And in fact, it's worth the price of admission, this little exchange. But of course, we have to remember at the end of the day that, you know, we're talking about, you know, we can talk about the Iraq War. We can talk about what it did to the U.S. position in the Middle East, to the position of Iran, and so on. Very, very relevant to this moment, of course. But we can also talk about, I think, you know, these enhanced interrogation techniques and what they did not only to the reputation of the United States, what they did not only to its political position by greatly helping the jihadists, greatly helping al-Qaeda and its allies, but also the effect they had simply on what the U.S. is and thinks it is. You know, its respect, very often honored in the breach, absolutely, but its role in promoting international law. And I think these decisions were absolutely disastrous for the country, absolutely disastrous. And I think that the film is valuable, very much so, in that it confronts this. And I've tried to, you know, write about this in the New York Review of Books and try to bring out these strains, not only in Errol Morris's movie, but also in Rumsfeld's enormous memoir and in a very good book about Rumsfeld by Bradley Graham, a biography, which is called By His Own Rules. So these pieces are about not only the film, but Rumsfeld's memoir and another biography as well.
Well, it certainly it takes quite a detached, a mind detached from reality to even entertain the idea of humane torture. But again, I'm speaking with Mark Danner, writer, journalist, and professor, longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and a regular contributor to The New Yorker Review of Books, where his latest article is Rumsfeld's War and Its Consequences Now. One of the interesting parts of history that you bring up in the article about Rumsfeld, Mark Danner, is this story about the father, George H.W., who the idea that both George H.W. and Don Rumsfeld were sitting in hotel rooms at the Republican convention when Ronald Reagan was about to be named president, wondering who he would pick as his vice president. And, of course, the phone rang for George H.W. and for Donald Rumsfeld, who really thought he had the inside track. And by in the Ford administration, shunting off George H.W. to the CIA, he thought he'd gotten rid of him because he couldn't run for VP. It gives you an idea of the arrogance. And, of course, you know, it's also worth reminding ourselves that Dick Cheney actually ran for president, you know, at one point.
Of course, he did indeed.
He was spectacularly unsuccessful.
He was indeed. Yes, no, I remember. I actually interviewed him around that time. The back story, as it were, which is just these men's biography, which you referred to earlier, is a fascinating one. I mean, the first thing to know is that Rumsfeld was enormously successful at a very young age. He was in his early 30s when he was elected to Congress from Illinois. He became very quickly one of the more influential congressmen, in part through his connections to Gerald Ford and other key figures. He joined the Nixon administration when he was in his late 30s. He had cabinet rank. He was running agencies. He was chief of staff to Gerald Ford. He saw Watergate from close on. He was chief of staff to Gerald Ford and then Secretary of Defense when he was in his early 40s. And Dick Cheney, of course, began work in Washington as his deputy, as his aide. In fact, Cheney used to joke when they were in the George W. Bush impression, he would introduce him by saying, he'd introduce Rumsfeld by saying, "I think of Don Rumsfeld as a fine Secretary of Defense. Don Rumsfeld thinks of Dick Cheney as a fine assistant to Don Rumsfeld." So these two men had a long history.
Right, they were a powerful tag team too.
That's why they
rolled over the kid, didn't they? That's the part we're running out of time. Just in the last minute here, the fact that they rolled over the kid and basically he didn't know what end was up. Why did the father not intervene, particularly on the going into war against Iraq?
Well, I think, you know, there are a couple of answers to that. One answer is you could say he did intervene in the form of Brent Scowcroft's celebrated essay in the Wall Street Journal, which was titled, I think, "Don't Go Into Iraq." Mm-hmm. And, of course, Scowcroft was national security advisor to George H.W. Bush, very close to him, had written a couple of books with him.
Sure.
So this, most people assumed that this was coming from the father. The interesting thing here, of course, is that this kind of father-son rivalry is borne out in the very person of Rumsfeld, which, as you said, I bring up in this first New York Review of Books article. When George W. Bush was thinking of who to hire for Secretary of Defense, and Rumsfeld was a candidate, James Baker, who'd been Secretary of State to George H.W. Bush and was kind of the family consigliere, said to George W. Bush, "You remember what he did to your daddy," meaning don't hire him. He was a jerk to your father. He shunted him out of the way. And, of course, George W. responded by hiring him.
Oh, God.
So there is a kind of, you know, you think, and Rumsfeld says in the film, well, he proved he was his own man, he says about George W.
Right. So, well, we don't have time to get into eatable matters here, but I thank you so much for joining us, Mark Danner. Again, Mark Danner is a writer, journalist, and professor, and a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker. He's a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books and teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, and at Bard College. And his books include The Secret Way to War, The Downing Street Memo, and The Iraq War's Buried History, and Torture and Truth, America's Abu Ghraib and the War on Terror. His latest article at The New York Review of Books is Rumsfeld's War and Its Consequences Now. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the implementation of the Volcker Rule.